The Guardian.
Hello, this is Music Weekly, and I'm Alexis Petridis. This week's programme is an extended interview with the composer Steve Reich. He's not perhaps someone you'd expect to hear on Music Weekly. We don't tend to cover a lot of modern classical music. But over the years, Steve Reich's influence on music from rock to techno has proved immense. You can hear it in Radiohead, Godspeed You Black Emperor, Brian Eno, Sufjan Stevens, Battles, and a host of others. Approaching his 75th birthday, 2011 is a landmark year in another way for Reich. In March, he premiered a piece he wrote to mark the 10th anniversary of the attack on the World Trade Center, called WTC 911, which he performed earlier this year at the Future Everything Festival in Manchester. That's where Ben Beaumont Thomas met up with him, and he began by asking him about the new piece. Having written about New York's benign side before, and living in the city, was it an inevitability that he was going to write about the attack?
They came from Boston, on an airline,
Not at all. When 9/11 happened, we lived four blocks from Ground Zero. My wife and I were in Vermont, 300 miles away. But my son and my granddaughter and my daughter-in-law were staying at our place, and I got a call at 8:30 in the morning saying, my son said, I think they bombed the World Trade Center again because they did it in 93. And you can't quite see the building from where we are because it was a large intervening building, but you could hear it and he could feel it. So we turned on the television set just in time to see the second plane hit. So without going through all the details, I just told him, don't hang up. And we had a 6-hour telephone connection until finally he and my granddaughter and daughter-in-law were taken by our neighbors who finally got their daughters home from school screaming and really upset, into a car, and were miraculously able to drive out of New York. I say that because the West Side Highway and the East Side Highway were all closed, and a lot of the streets were filled with people just running. All of which is to say that it wasn't a media event. It was a very terrifying personal event. But when it happened, I and Beryl Korot, my wife, were in the middle of finishing Three Tales, which is a video opera about technology in the 20th century. And there was no time to do anything but finish it. We had a deadline.
We and all other animals. We and all our machines. Machine. Created by our genes. Our machines.
Some people asked me what you've just asked me, knowing that I worked with documentary material. You know, well, will you do a piece on 9/11? I said, look, I'm up to here with samples of all kinds of stuff, and frankly, you know, I'm just fed up with it. I can't deal with another. If I see one more sample, I'm going to get sick. So for the moment, no. You know, we'll see. So we finished Three Tales in 2002, and for 7 years, I wrote just music for instruments and voices. In 2009, I got a call from David Harrington from the Kronos Quartet saying, would you write us a third piece using pre-recorded voices once again? And I said, David, you know, for you, absolutely. But when I hung up the phone, I had no thoughts in my mind whatsoever as to what on earth I would do. I had only one thought in my mind, which had nothing to do with 9/11. The thought in my mind was a purely formal thought. I wanted to take the final vowel or consonant of any thing that was said by anybody and prolong it. This adds up to zero, zero, and the O goes on indefinitely, because you can do that now with a computer. And what's more, you can have a viola or a violin or a cello double that, and then the next speaker is held. And sometimes, like one of the speakers from NORAD who's describing the American Flight 11 is going off course, says, no contact with the pilot, no contact with the pilot whatsoever, and he holds the R, which comes like a growl.
No contact with the pilot. No contact with the pilot whatsoever.
So you have vowels that are pitches that are being held by previous speakers, joined by noise bands of the present speaker. So it creates a kind of fog over the whole piece, which is also a kind of connecting link between one speaker and the following speaker, not just psychologically, but harmonically. And that is really what I had in mind, but I had no idea who was speaking. I just had this formal idea. Well, about 2 or 3 months into it, finally, it's as if the light bulb went on, and I thought to myself, I have unfinished business. And then suddenly it was immediately clear what I had to do, and I went about collecting materials that were public domain from NORAD, which is the traffic controllers who chart what's flying across North America, and saw this plane from Boston to LA going south, which is definitely not the way to go. And then the voices of the New York City Fire Department, who have what they call field communications, which became on the web. And these are sometimes noisy, sometimes impossible to understand, and sometimes extremely emotional and moving. So I took some of that, and then that's the whole first movement, which is really rather rapid and extremely intense. The second movement is myself making interviews with my friends and neighbors 10 years later, having them remember what happened to them that day. So one of the first speakers is David Lang, the composer from Bang on a Can, who's a very good friend, who said, I was taking my kids to school. And the plane went over his head, and they had to duck, and it crashed into the building. So the second movement is reflections on that. The third movement is other people who were there at the time. There is a tradition and law in Judaism that says from the time that a person dies until the time that they're buried, they're not to be left alone. During 9/11, there were some bodies found, but a lot of body parts were found. And they were all taken to the medical examiner's office, which is on the East 30s in Manhattan. And a number of synagogue members from way uptown were coming down to sit, keep the bodies, parts of bodies company, and say psalms, which is what you traditionally do. Now, the reason behind this is probably twofold. One of it goes back to very simple physical reasons in the old days, and even now, you don't want the corpse or whatever the corpse remains are to be disturbed, insects, animals, what have you. The other is a spiritual one of saying somehow we call neshama, the soul is sort of hovering over the body, waiting for the burial so that it's free to go wherever the soul is going to go. So that's the reason behind it. Well, from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown is the Sabbath in Judaism. And these people who are trooping down from, 110th Street by subway or, bus or taxi or whatever, it was a long walk to go down to the East 30s. So they started looking for people who would be very nearby. And they found these women at Stern College, which is on Lexington and 30th Street. And a number of the women said, we'd be honored to do this. So they started arranging shifts, so many hours, and replacing each other, singing, chanting, saying psalms and part of the Bible around the clock for these unknown dead. And because of the fact that we didn't have whole bodies, this went on for 7 months of DNA identification. So it was a long process. And I read about this in the New York Times. I had come back to Judaism years earlier, but didn't know about this particular practice. And it struck me as a very beautiful thing in an otherwise, pretty gruesome and horrible situation. So when the time came to make this piece, I thought, I want to find some of these women and speak to them as well. And I found two of them. One had come in from Seattle, and the other one had been the president of Boosie and Hawks, my music publisher, and who had actually fulfilled this duty during this time.
Fastest train. Going back to this idea that you mentioned of doubling, you have, the musicality of a sample voice is mimicked in the instrumentation, and that's something you did with Different Trains, which was reflecting on the Holocaust. I mean, what is it about that doubling process and that turning of the of voice into music that you sort of find compelling as a kind of compositional technique?
Well, if someone had come to me and said, "Steve, would you like to write a piece about the Holocaust?" I'd say, "Are you mad? You know, what do? Drink the Atlantic Ocean for starters?" I mean, it's just something I would run from. I have no idea how to deal with it. And the same thing if someone said, well, would you do a piece about 9/11? Well, what do you mean a piece about 9/11? I'll write a piece of music that emotes my emotions about the loss of lives of those people I didn't even know? It just seems absurd to me. So the only way to deal with events like this, in my view, and it probably dates back to the earliest tape pieces that's going to rain and come out, is to go to the documentary sources that participated in that event. Now, in Different Trains, actually, the piece begins autobiographically about the trips that I made between my divorced singer-songwriter mother in California and my lawyer father in New York, accompanied by my nanny and Black Pullman Porter, whose voices are there talking about their lives in the trips that they made in these trains. And when I came to the Holocaust people, I realized, well, the only way to deal with this is to get Holocaust survivors on tape talking about their lives. And the tone of voice, the speech melody, contains within it the true intensity of the event, not a dramatization thereof, not a fantasy thereof, but a retelling of a witness.
Germans invaded Hungary. I was in second grade.
And 9/11 is the exact same thing. I mean, the air controllers are concerned, confused, and that concern and confusion is in their voices. And if I can present that with the pitches that are in his voice and the appropriate surrounding harmony, then I will have something which is not a dramatization, but an intensification, musically speaking, of something that happened, and that therefore becomes believable and acceptable.
He said, after all, it's going to rain after all, for 40 days and for 40 nights. And the people didn't believe him. And they began to laugh at him. And they began to mock him. And they began to say, it ain't going to rain.
Because with It's Going to Rain and Come Out, these very early pieces that are almost entirely based around sample voices and phasing those, and the way that you manipulate them, it seems like the words are almost robbed of their meaning. But then your later work, they seem very rich with meaning, you know, these sort of very resonant primary sources from NORAD and so on. I mean, has your relationship to vocal sources changed over the years? Are you finding you want to do different things with it?
Well, certainly It's Going to Rain and Come Out, as you properly point out, in going out of phase, become, quote, unrecognizable. But the important thing about both of those pieces is that at the very beginning you hear exactly what's being said by the black preacher and the black kid who's arrested for murder. And therefore, there's a kind of an intensification to my ear of what they say as it becomes more abstractly come out to show them the shh sh- becomes maracas, but it's still emotional quality of his voice, although abstracted from the actual words, is musically still there, it seems to me. And the same thing with the guy who's especially in It's Going to Rain. The second movement thereof is he's talking about people pounding on the door of the ark trying to get in, but it was locked, sealed by the hand of God. And as they begin to go further out of phase and turn from speech into noise, I believe you are hearing, to my way of thinking, the end of the world before your very ears.
Thank you.
Now, also remember that It's Gonna Rain was done in 65. The Cuban Missile Crisis was about 2 years before that. It was actually recorded in 64 and realized in January 65. Well, I mean, that was very fresh in every American's mind. But when this preacher is talking about the end of the world and Noah, it has the resonance of a very recent event, which is a fiery end of the world. So for me, those pieces, yes, they are abstract in that they create sounds which are not literal words in the sense in which they are literal words in the later pieces. But they are carrying the same meaning, musically speaking, as they started out, if not more. My feeling was, you talk about the end of the world, I want to create the end of the world.
And then a little later in your career, you start to reflect on perhaps your own Jewish heritage, and you start to create work like Tehillim, which has this very, very musical Hebrew singing in it. I mean, were you initially attracted to the musicality of Hebrew, or were you attracted to, you know, your own Jewish identity and that as a part of composition?
Tehillim is a very important piece. I think it's up there with Music for 18 Musicians and Drumming and UR Variations and Double Sextet and a few other pieces that I think very highly of. But the answer to your question is that I got involved in Judaism and I felt two things. I felt I'd like to express this in my music, and I haven't written any vocal music. I mean, I've got singers going doo 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 doo, sounding like marimbas in drumming, and I've got singers going ee in Music for 18 Musicians, but I haven't got any singers singing. So how about doing what people have been doing for thousands of years? I had tried to do this as a student when I was at Juilliard and felt that I had failed and I had not done a good job. But when Tehillim came along, I just went through the Book of Psalms, because the Psalms are eminently, we know that they were written to be sung. We don't have, in the West, fortunately, I think, we have lost that tradition. And if you go to a synagogue in London or Manchester or Cologne or New York, and you hear Jews singing Psalms, they're basically using borrowed tunes, probably from the church in the 18th to 19th century. The only Jews on earth who have a living tradition of Psalms that is still alive are the Yemenite Jews. And I'm not a Yemenite, and I don't know that tradition. So I was free to compose using that text. And I tried to find sections of Psalms that I felt, like I said, anyone, Jew, Gentile, whatever. And I think it succeeds. And it ends with a hallelujah in D major. And how can you lose with a hallelujah in D major?
And then sort of as sampling technology sort of comes into play, you really sort of engaged with that, and your wife also, you collaborated together on using video, which was, I think, in the mid-80s, quite a radical thing to be doing. I mean, do you find that sometimes maybe your contemporaries in the classical world, are you surprised they don't tend to use this sort of technology more in their composition? Or do you think that they're perhaps resistant to technology?
Oh, no, I think people are running pell-mell to use as much technology as they possibly can, and that's natural. I mean, technology in music today is our folk music, is how I see it. I mean, if you go into a music store here in Manchester, you go into a music store in London or Tokyo or New York City, what do you see in the window? You see digital delays, new foot pedals, you know, the latest in Apple, iPhones, computers, audio accessories. And occasionally you might find an electric guitar, which is already becoming a kind of antique. Mm-hmm. So we have people making, music on their laptops. And this is to be expected in a culture that's dealing with these artifacts every day. It would be odd if they didn't. And I think many, many composers are. I noticed Thomas Addis is working with Tal Rosner here, who's a video artist. I think people are all over the place trying to incorporate. I think Bill Viola is going to do a Wagner production on the request of a large organization. So I think that this is an unstoppable and quite natural and normal to be expected. I mean, you know, our folk culture is no longer playing dulcimers and guitars and, you know, like Woody Guthrie did. You know, that was for Bob Dylan, but this, we're living in another time.
Do you think that you might reflect on sort of the internet and this kind of new digital culture that kind of is the one step beyond sampling and sort of video culture? Is that something that kind of enters your mind when you're thinking about your own work?
It hasn't as yet. I'm living offline as much as possible. So far I've avoided Facebook and Twitter and their associates. So I don't know. I really don't know. And my plans for the next pieces are instrumental musical pieces. But I don't know how long I live, and I don't know what the future will bring. And what you say is certainly part of what's going on. And it took a long time to do, you know, this WGC 9/11, which began our discussion, was not on my mind until David brought it to my mind. And then when he did, I thought, well, you know, how am I going to deal with it? And I'd forgotten all the software. It had all moved 6 or 7 versions beyond what I had used. There were other things available. So it took me a good 2 or 3 months of just sort of getting my software together before I could even begin. And so we'll see what the future brings.
Yeah. Are there any techno artists and artists that use repetition and pulse and so on in kind of contemporary culture now that you listen to and respect?
I heard the In Rainbows, I forget the name of the tune, one of the In Rainbows tunes of Radiohead was quite impressive, just as a song. You know, I appreciated some of the, there have been remix contests, several of them here in UK, which I had to judge some, and I think some people did, you know, some really worthwhile things. This is an old tradition. I mean, you know, Brahms' variation on Haydn is not remixing, but it is taking someone's music that precedes you and then doing something that you do to it. So this is taking pre-existing music and then treating it in the style in which you work, which is now done electronically by and large, is a very old and a very honored and a very, you know, to be accepted tradition. And I'm delighted and happy that, you know, that I'm included, because it means that people who I don't know at all and who probably weren't born when I did It's Gonna Rain still find something of interest in my music and want to incorporate it into theirs. So that as a phenomenon is something that I much appreciate.
Steve Reich there with Ben Beaumont Thomas. And that's it for this week's Music Weekly. I'm Alexis Petridis, the producer was Scott Corley, and I'll be back again next week with a regular programme. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.